And welcome back to School for Startups Radio again. Thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited to introduce you to my next guest. His name is Jim Mascara. He has had a very interesting career. He started off in the telecommunications space, but he quickly realized that he had a lot more to give and had a lot of other interests. And so he has, for the last several years, been running a company called Sentinel Consulting, and they have a publication which is devoted to helping small and middle-sized businesses. Jim also in the 1990s realized that there was something seriously wrong with the stock market, and gosh, I wish I had gotten his advice then. And over the next several years, he spent time building the Sentinel Financial Report, which has helped other small business owners around the country be aware of the things that he saw coming. That publication was eventually turned into a book called Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis, and was followed up in 2015 by another book called Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis. Now, let's come up to where we are today. He has just released a new book, a novel, a thriller about politics, the financial crisis, and cyber terror. It could not be more apropos for the times today. The book is called 2020 and introduces us to a new hero, Chandler Scott. I can't wait to learn all about it. Looks like it'd be right up my alley. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Jim, good afternoon. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, I'm excited to learn about the book and find out more about your business, Sentinel. It looks like it would be very useful for our listeners. Let's start off with the book. Why'd you write 2020? What's going on?
Well, they say for you to write about the things that you know and understand. And my forte, as you mentioned, I delved a lot into the financial markets. Really, starting about 1987 is when I got my baptism, I guess, when the stock market crashed. I happened to be on the right side of some trades on October 19th, 1987. So that kind of propelled me into the world of commodity trading. And again, I was doing this in parallel to my job in the telecommunications world. After the financial crisis in 2008, I decided to create a publication, which I called the Sentinel Financial Report, which was a macro analysis, if you will, of the stock market, interest rates, currency, precious metals, real estate, and so forth. And then after doing that for a couple of years, I thought, you know, I've got enough material here to create a book, and I wanted to create a book that was called Escaping Oz, as you mentioned, Protecting Your Wealth in a Financial Crisis, to get people to understand the bread and butter, the mechanics of what happens in an economy. Because it really, when you see some of these headlines that come on TV news, et cetera, you don't really, I don't get the sense anyway that most people really understand what kind of lies behind that. And these are really important because, you know, we elect a president and obviously other elected leaders every 2 or 4 years on a national level. And I always thought it was, you know, my responsibility anyway from a civic perspective to put something out there that people could use as a tool to then try to ask the right questions. That's really, really important to ask the right questions. So in 2015, there was a follow-up to that, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, which talked a little bit more about the Federal Reserve. And I devoted a chapter in that book I called, you know, what do you want government to be? Because I think that's something that the country struggles with all the time is that you have one side that says, okay, we need to have a health care maybe that goes to a single payer. And then the other side said, no, 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 that's socialism. So we really need to come to some real fundamental decisions. So that all formed, let's say, the backdrop, if you will, to creating a novel, which is entitled 2020, which I just released. Again, it's a political thriller that takes into account some real-world conditions that I see right now, which is financial crisis, cyber terror, which most people don't really think about too much. But probably one of the things that I think would grab people's attention right now is the whole political process. I think anybody that's been watching the news here in the last few months could attest to we've had a very interesting political race here for president. And one of the premises of 2020 is the introduction of what I'll call freestanding political parties that you would consider third party, and not like what you saw Ross Perot do in 1992. These are parties that, you know, will, you know, kind of created from a grassroots perspective and then move forward from this point to challenge the two-party system. So the 2020 basically takes into account financial crisis, cyber terror, and then these alternative parties challenging the two-party status quo. And then it culminates in the presidential election of 2020, and then some very explosive things happen there. And my goal is to leave people thinking, hey, you know, could this really happen?
All right. Who are the two candidates in 2020? Are they close to real people or are they completely fictional?
Well, there's actually four candidates for president in the election of 2020. And I think a point that is probably missing in a lot of the political analysis right now is, you know, the two political candidates that we have that are running for president, the main political candidates, you know, they have this overwhelming negative rating for both of them. And, you know, if you stop to think about it, well, why is that the case? Well, it's a dissatisfaction of the electorate with the two main parties. Now, this year you had, I identified anyway, three candidates that ran for president that do not fit any particular mold of either being a Democrat or Republican. The first candidate is Dr. Ben Carson. Second candidate is Donald Trump. And then the third candidate is Bernie Sanders. When you look at the candidacies of each one of those people, they would have had a very difficult time. And as a matter of fact, I think I heard Bernie Sanders and Trump say the same thing. They could not run as an independent candidate because, A, well, they didn't really have a party to run into. They could just say, well, I'm generically independent. B, they knew that fundraising would be very, very difficult. And C, that they wouldn't get the press attention that they might deserve. But you saw what a strong candidacy Bernie Sanders had in challenging Secretary Clinton. And, you know, to the surprise of many political pundits, the Republican nominee right now is Donald Trump. Well, and that shouldn't come as a surprise to some people when you see how dissatisfied the electorate is going all the way back to 2009 when you saw the Tea Party. So those three gentlemen there, since they don't fit the mold, didn't fit the mold of their parties, what you're starting to see right now, which, again, comes to fruition in my book 2020, again, is a fictional account, is the first kind of inkling there of such strong dissatisfaction that it could, and I want to emphasize could, form the basis of a viable third party or third parties moving into the year 2018 and then 2020.
All right. Right now, we actually do have four candidates. We have Trump and Clinton, but we also have Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, and Jill Stein, who I don't remember the name of the party she's running with, a Green Party or something like that. Do you think that Gary Johnson, for example, with the Libertarian movement, has a chance to become this third party that you're talking about? What side of the spectrum do you think it'll come from, Jim?
Yeah, I would say no, and I'll qualify that. I mean, the Libertarian Party has had a candidate, obviously, for many elections. The Green Party, which you mentioned, Jill Stein, they've had a candidate in many elections. What I think you will see this time, though, and if the polls that I see on the national level are correct, maybe, just maybe, you may see as much as 15% of the vote go to candidates that are not named Trump or Clinton. The reason I don't think that the Libertarian Party in and of itself will be successful, let's say, in 2018, again, for a serious challenge to the presidency, is because I think their messaging for some people that are traditional Republicans or Democrats probably doesn't fit the mold of what they really want. What I'm really interested to see right now is what happens with all of those voters that were behind Bernie Sanders. And also, what will happen to the voters that voted for Mr. Trump, presuming, you know, let's say he loses. So if you think that Secretary Clinton's going to win, you'll have a loser with Donald Trump. You'll have a very, very fractured Republican Party. I mean, I think anyone can see that even right now. But then you'll also have this mass of people that were very strongly behind Senator Sanders. That, you know, where do they go? And so that's kind of those are the let's say focus groups, if you will, right now that I'm looking at to see what happens with them. Do they coalesce into some sort of party, and then do they make a charge in 2018 and 2020?
All right. Do we need to know which side of the political spectrum you're on, Jim, or is that irrelevant?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm actually an independent voter. I voted for Republican candidates in the past. I voted for Democrats. I have voted for Libertarian candidates as well. So I'm kind of a mixture, I guess, of all of the different candidacies. But I will tell you, though, that there's some personal view expressed in some of the candidacies that you will see in the book.
Well, tell me about the thriller aspect of the book, Jim. Is there a bad guy out there trying to kill off candidates or something? How does it become a thriller? We got to have a bad guy, right?
I'm sorry?
We have to have a bad guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's antagonists. You know, the protagonist, as you mentioned, is he's a TV journalist named Chandler Scott. And Chandler Scott is a character that grew up in a single family household, didn't have really much of a relationship with his father. And then as he matured, his relationship was more of a an older brother than a father-son relationship. So he always seeks out and has needed to seek out mentors. But on the other side, after a significant event occurs in the U.S. economy in the year 2019, there are competing interests, if you will, in government and what I'll call really shadow organizations, think tanks, global, let's say, banking organizations, for lack of a better term, that they have a way that they want to resolve some of the problems. And these problems linger in real time from the year 2008, which, of course, we all physically experienced. But in the year 2019, there was another significant financial event. So you've got these competing interests trying to figure out, okay, how do we solve these problems? You've got the public that is looking for answers. You know, they're suffering, financially and economically. So they're asking their elected leaders, hey, you need to help us. And the Federal Reserve at this point has been completely discredited in terms of some of their machinations that, you know, they did in the past. So the president is really left in a very difficult position. Well, how do I execute what I'm supposed to do in this office, which is, you know, protect and serve the citizens of the United States. So these outside interests, if you will, that, you might consider them the antagonist in the story. You know, they start to influence a lot of public policy, and through that, there's some other organizations that are created. Anyway, there's I wouldn't say a conspiracy, if you will, but all of these interests then compete for policy within the United States. There's new policy set up, but at the same time, you know, government then becomes more and more authoritarian. So there's people on one side that don't like that, and another side that say, you know, hey, at least we're trying to stabilize things in the country.
All right. From your macroeconomic perspective, how do we sit right now? Are we on the cusp of a strong recovery? Is this weak recovery going to continue a while? Are we on the precipice of a bottomless Ginnegaw-gap type pit that goes on forever and our economy is destined to die and we all end up poor?
Well, it's a false recovery. And the reason I say it's a false recovery is because there are many measures where you look at, and you can look at measures like GDP growth, which I think, I mean, they're well-publicized, they're very anemic. The unemployment rate has dropped significantly, which obviously is a very, very good thing, but there's some mixed views in that unemployment number, which is, A, how it gets measured now, you know, versus how it did in during the, I think, the Carter administration. So if you look at just that measure, well, the unemployment number doesn't look quite as rosy. In fact, it's nowhere near as rosy. You also have incredible levels of debt that have been accumulated in non-revolving credit, you know, things like student loans. Now automobile loans are extending out, you know, beyond 7 years. That's kind of a dangerous sign in and of itself. You've got corporate debt, which has gone really, really sky high as a result of obviously, low-interest borrowing that has been created, but that low-interest borrowing, instead of going, you know, being filtered back into increasing, you know, productivity, has gone into share buybacks. Those are well-documented. So it's a very, very false recovery at this point in time, very tenuous recovery, and there are many indicators that if you look at, the Baltic Dry Index is one. There's other production indices that indicate that, again, with a very, very tenuous recovery, it's some small catalyst could set the economy back very, very quickly. In England, I guess a couple months ago, about a month and a half ago, you had the famous Brexit, and of course there were all sorts of pronouncements about what could happen, you know, as a result of that. But it's a very, very tenuous recovery, and I tend to watch the stock market, and whenever the major indices in the United States break, I think that you'll see, you know, probably a continuation of something, you know, much more significant ahead.
All right, so do you think that means that the next recession is worse than 2007, 2008?
Yes, I do, because there's more to deleverage, and that's one of the things that happens, you know, during a recessionary period, depressionary periods, is the leverage that was created in the boom period, if you will, it just it, it it starts to unwind, right? And so people are willing, not willing to borrow as much. Lenders are willing to lend less. And since so much credit has been built up, you know, certainly since 2008, that has to deflate. And so when that happens, and really that's what the Fed has been fighting now since 2008. They've been fighting the forces of deflation. They've increased their balance sheets by over $4 trillion during that time frame. So if you look at it from, you know, the old macroeconomic perspective that you might have learned in school, somebody would have told you, well, the Fed's going to increase their balance sheet by $4 trillion. You think, wow, there's going to be this significant inflation. You know, groceries are going to cost $1,000 for a, you know, for a loaf of bread. I'm exaggerating, of course, but that hasn't happened. And the reason it hasn't happened is because there's these significant deflationary headwinds that the Fed has fought. I mean, and that's the number one enemy for a central banker is deflation.
All right. It sounds pretty disheartening, Jim. The picture you're painting is pretty scary. How can the book end on an upbeat note then? And the book has to end happy, or thrillers end happy with the good guy winning, right? Isn't that the definition of a thriller? How does the book reconcile the fact that thrillers normally end up happy with the incredible, dangerous scenario that we find ourselves in?
Well, without giving away the ending of the book.
Yeah, I don't want to know that. Yeah.
Yeah, I will tell you that it folds very well into a second book, which actually I'm in the process of writing right now. Hopefully I'll publish it maybe after the election. There was really no way, Jim, to resolve the entire story in one book. And the reason, if that's the case, is because then the book would have been too long. So I've got, you know, some semblance of how long the book really needed to be to make it interesting. So I would say that it doesn't necessarily end happy. It doesn't end sad either. Let's just say it ends somewhat unresolved. And so when, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint of, you know, some of these trilogies like, you know, Hunger Games and so forth, you could tell when you finish the first book, or if you saw the movie, well,
right,
it's not,
sure.
There's more to come.
Yep. Definitely.
Yeah. So I will just tell you, when you finish the book, and for a couple of reviews that I've gotten so far on Amazon, they've told me that they've related that they came away thinking that, okay, maybe this could really happen. And that's really what the point I want to try to get across is, yeah, this is all fictional, but there's a lot of historical basis of what I'm talking about. There's a lot of reality to it. And to get people to think, you know, maybe this could really happen, and I need to think about it. And one lady that read it, she wrote me an email. She said, you know, I finished your book. I really enjoyed it, but I came away concerned, is what she told me. So basically, it'll just be something that's unresolved, but, you know, more to come after that.
All right. Well, it looks like a fascinating book, and I think most of the listeners would enjoy the daylights out of it. It is certainly a topic that is important to us. But I want to change the topic of conversation, Jim. Tell people about Sentinel Consulting and how you can help raise money for my small business listeners.
Small businesses have really struggled in the capital acquisition phase of their development. Certainly since 2008, I'm located in St. Louis, Missouri, so I periodically meet with the banking community here. And so I know the some of the stress that small business owners have in getting capital from commercial banks. And it's not always the commercial bank's fault. There's some new regulations that obviously came into play after 2008. And that's what I try to talk to my small business clients about, is that, you know, don't throw daggers at the commercial bankers, because it's not always their fault. On top of that, what I was talking about earlier, this deleveraging aspect, you know, that's part of the deflationary psychology that takes place even among bankers, where they're not willing to make those same loans that they were before, not just because they might have a regulator knocking on their door, but because they are more risk-averse. And so because of that, there is a niche, if you will, that's been created, I would suggest to you, post-2008, where a small business owner who needs capital, you know, for whatever reason they need the capital, they need to have an alternative source of financing. So I'm set up, if you will, as a consultant that will try to match their needs with a pool, if you will, of lenders that I use, from anything, you know, from short-term loans, asset-based lending. I'll work with churches to do church financing. I try to stay away from some of the higher end loan products that I see out there, merchant cash advances. I mean, I see those kind of popping up, and which are good, I think, for certainly good for the vendors, sometimes good for the businesses, but then they end up with very, very high interest rates. So we try to help them out of that. So two ways we help them. One, capital acquisition, so small business financing. But the other is when they find themselves in a debt problem that may result in civil litigation, we try to work with their creditors in a debt restructuring exercise, a negotiation, if you will, to help let's say settle that debt at a different point that doesn't involve going through the litigation process, which is almost never fruitful for a small business or the creditor.
All right, very interesting. So you're not working with true startups. You're working with people who already have some revenue, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Big distinction there for our listeners. Well, Jim, fascinating stuff, fascinating career. You're doing some very interesting stuff and putting it together into a really interesting, cool-looking puzzle. So congratulations. I love it.
Thank you.
And this looks like the perfect summer read for us as we get ready for the election, doesn't it?
I think, again, my goal is that when you finish with the book, hopefully you'll enjoy it. I think the storyline is the strength of the book. There's a lot of material behind it, and there's a lot of reality behind it. And that's really my goal, is to help you kind of, you know, merge that reality with a fictional story that could be entertaining for you as well.
All right. Do you want to tell us who you're voting for?
I don't think I'm going to be voting for either of the two major candidates. I'm pretty well convinced of that.
All right. I can certainly understand and respect that as well. I agree with you. I would love to vote for Gary Johnson. I'm just concerned, to be 100% honest with you, Jim, that he's too high.
Well, you know, I think his most recent venture was as a CEO of a company, obviously, that was developing cannabis and so forth. I mean, the Libertarians have a good platform, and I think that if you look at the candidacy of a Ron Paul from 4 years ago, you'll see some of those Libertarian leanings in there. But again, this is what I'm getting at. He wasn't a Libertarian; he was a Republican, and
right.
that's the challenge right now, is to try to get people away from the two major parties so they can be, again, one of these fictional standalone parties that I mentioned in my book, that, you know, they can raise money, they can be on TV, you know, they can engage in debate, they can be on that debate stage, you know, during the presidential debate. That's what's really important. And until you get that, I think you're going to be stuck in this two-party system. And again, I mean, this election probably reflects it better than anyone else that I've seen since I've been a voter, which is just the absolute disdain for both candidacies. And I mean, that's not good for the country.
Right. Well, I certainly agree with that disdain. I find both candidates just massively flawed. And so it will be a hard election for me as well. Jim, how can people find out more about you, get themselves a copy of the book, follow you on social media, all that kind of stuff, please?
My author website is www.jimmosquera.com. So that's Jim, J-I-M. My last name is spelled M-O-S-Q-U-E-R-A.com. My book, 2020, has its own website, which is integrated with the first one. And that's at 2020novel, NOVEL.info, INFO. So if you do both of those, you'll be able to get to all my books. And then my business is Sentinel Consulting, as we talked about before.
Fantastic. Jim, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope that some of your good predictions come true.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim, for having me on your show.
All right, and we will be right back.